In the summer of 1816, Britain's preeminent literary celebrities rented a gorgeous Swiss lakeside cottage for creative inspiration. Little did they know that dark forces and torrential rain would disrupt their summer, relationships, and ultimate fate, but inspire some of Britain's most celebrated Gothic horror novels. And today's pilot, Darklings, tells that story, so don't move a muscle.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Unproduced Table Read here on the Popcorn Talk Network. For those of you just joining for the first time, this is a show where we read Hollywood's hottest unproduced pilots and features, and we have a creepy one today. We are reading Eileen Shim's really elegant, terrifying pilot, Darklings. And Eileen, we're so happy to have you here today. Thank you for being here. I love this script and I can't wait to get into it. And I'm going to have you kind of give us some context into the script before we actually read it for our listeners. But before we dive in, I'd love for my cast to introduce themselves before we get started.
What's up, everybody? I am Timothy Michael. You can find me on all social media platforms at I am Timothy Mike. Today I will be reading Percy Shelley and Watchmen.
Hey guys, I'm Roxy Stryer. You can find me everywhere at Roxy Stryer. And I will be reading for Mary and a couple lines for Maid.
Everybody, I'm Andrew Guy. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Andrew Guy. And today I'll be reading for Lord Byron, Magistrate Corner, and The Guard.
Hi, everybody. I'm William Pinkham. You can find me online at william.pinkham. I am reading Westbrook, Fletcher, Resurrectionist, Protester, and Polidori.
Hey, guys. I'm Adrienne Snow. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Miss Adrienne Snow. And I'm reading Madame Celine and Harriet.
Hey, I am Haley O'Connor. And today I'm reading for Claire.
Just an FYI, guys, for those watching this show, you will see Adrienne sneak out in the middle of our read. It's because she has an audition, which is great news. She's not just bailing on the show. So.
I feel like for once and for all, we need to make an order of who goes first on the couch. Yeah.
Right. I know. That's been an issue for 28 shows.
Never address it.
Eileen, thank you for being here today.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Good. We love the script. What I'd love for you to do is, before we dive in, kind of describe the world we're entering and give us 1 to 2 minutes just to kind of set the tone and the mood for us, if you would.
Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you think of Gothic horror, you think about these iconic creatures, the vampire, Frankenstein's monster. And for me, you know, it's a pilot that kind of pulls back the curtain and you see the creative, tormented geniuses behind these creations. Mm. And I like to kind of describe it as, you know, Gossip Girl set in Gothic horror. You have, you know, sex and intrigue and mind games and supernatural occult experiments and seances. And, you know, you have the most famous literary set of that time in England, all in gathered in one place, challenging each other to create the most horrifying, nightmarish things possible. So as a writer who loves, you know, the Gothic, sci-fi, supernatural fantasy genre, for me, it was kind of writing about my literary idols, but really humanizing them and bringing them down to earth and seeing their kind of flawed, jealous, mysterious sides and making it more accessible to a modern day audience.
Beautifully said. And what's cool about this script, too, is it's set in a location in Switzerland called Villa Diodati, which is real. And this summer that you're describing, I know some of it's maybe a little bit elaborated, but a lot of what we're reading, there's like kind of urban legends that this stuff is true, right?
Yes. It's a very famous summer. They call it the year without a summer, actually, because a volcano had just exploded off of Indonesia, covering a lot of the Western Hemisphere in ash. So this is a real life occurrence where these five very brilliant minds were kind of trapped in a mansion, not being able to go out during this torrential downpour. And because they were trapped in a house together, you know, there was a lot of drugs, a lot of alcohol, a lot of sex, and a lot of literary challenges where they're really trying to one-up each other and see who can creep out the others the most. So that kind of provided this perfect backdrop to explore these creative minds and see what their twisted minds were able to come up with.
Freaky. Well, let's get into it. We gotta go now. Yeah.
I kind of have shivers.
I know. Already. All right, guys, this is the pilot to Darklings, written by Eileen Shim, and this pilot is inspired by the lives of the Romantics. Cold open. Exterior meadow day. An idyllic spring afternoon. A young couple lounges on a picnic blanket. Mary Godwin, 19, raven hair and dark, serious eyes, fidgets with a piece of paper. Percy Shelley, 25, a mess of curls and boyish charm, rests his head in her lap.
It's not finished.
No matter. I want to hear it.
A child's laughter rings across the meadow. Mary looks over to see their son, William, 2 years old, dart through the tall grass, chased by Mary's sister, Claire, 20 years old, effusive and blonde.
Go on, Mary.
Mary tears her eyes away from her son and softens at Percy's adoring gaze. She steadies herself before reading.
Gentle sleep shall veil my sight, Psyche's lamp shall darkling be, when in the visions of the night thou dost renew thy vows to me.
Mary jolts at the sound of William shrieking in delight. Claire is caught up to the giggling toddler, who squirms out of her grasp and starts chasing her instead. Percy laces his fingers with Mary's, waiting for the rest.
Come to me in dreams, my love. I will not ask a dearer bliss. Come with the starry beams, my love. Press mine eyelids with thy kiss.
Percy reaches up and does as she says. Their kiss grows more insistent until Claire plops down in the blanket.
Am I interrupting here?
Mary swats at her, laughing, then stops with sudden concern.
Where's William?
Oh, he's right. He was just behind me.
Mary pushes Percy aside to get up and scan the meadow.
William? William!
He's nowhere in sight. Mary only hears the rustle of the wind until somewhere amid the tall grass, she hears William screaming in pain. Mary sprints across the field toward the sound. She makes a wild sweep through the grass, panic rising in her chest, until she sees William crumpled on the ground, clutching a grazed knee. Relieved, she hurries over to him.
Oh, show me where it hurts.
William sniffles and lets her inspect the knee. As she leans in closer, Mary sees something writhing inside. She recoils in horror just as a worm wriggles out of the womb. William doubles over in pain, crying as the womb lets out a torrent of worms, maggots, and beetles. Mary staggers up, seized with horror.
Percy! Claire!
Both are gone. The picturesque meadow has transformed into a desolate graveyard. Mary turns to find all that is left of her child is a writhing pile of vermin, which pool at her feet and pull her into the ground, into a sinkhole. Mary screams, scrambling to get away until she stops. The fight goes out of her. She closes her eyes, letting herself be swallowed whole by the multiplying mound of worms and insects.
Mary! Mary!
Cut to. Interior London apartment night. Mary's eyes roll white as her body quakes and contorts in a seizure. Black foam gathers at the corners of her mouth.
Mary?
They're holding hands around in a circular candlelit table. Mary, Percy, Claire, and Madame Celine, 60s, an emaciated clairvoyant medium. The crammed apartment is filled with dark smoke rising from a crucible filled with laudanum. Percy tries to rush to Mary's side, but Madame Celine grips his hand tighter.
She's trying to stay in the other side. Cannot break the circle.
Percy shakes from Madame Celine's grasp and hurries to Mary. He cradles her pale face as she chokes up black foam. Her flailing limbs knock several bottles onto the floor.
Mary, please. Please wake up.
We must allow her to choose.
It's the laudanum. Get my bag.
Claire snaps out of her shocked reverie to fetch Percy's medical bag. He digs around until he finds an amber vial.
Hold her mouth open.
Claire complies. Percy squeezes a few drops of tincture into Mary's mouth. After a few seconds, Mary's body shakes with violence until it goes completely still. Percy holds her with tender affection as she gradually stirs. Her eyes blink open, back to their normal dark color.
Mary, it's me.
Mary's eyes snap to focus and she shoves him aside.
Why did you wake me?
Mary, we had to.
Take me back.
The withered medium shakes her head.
You will not survive a return so soon to the other side.
Please, I have to go back. I'll give you anything.
I'm very sorry.
Please, take me back there.
Mary rails against Percy as he tries to hold her back.
Oh, take me back to my son.
She collapses into sobs. Percy attempts to embrace her, but she pushes him away with savage force. He watches her stagger away from the table, helpless. Interior London apartment night later. Mary lies in bed, her back turned to Percy and Claire as they whisper across the room.
We cannot allow her to do this again. She's too fragile.
I wonder why that is.
I'm only trying to protect her.
You cannot protect what you've already broken.
Claire, I know you care for her as much as I do. Please, we must put an end to this madness.
Claire takes Percy's coat off the rack and shoves it at him.
Go home, Percy. Your saintly wife must be waiting on hand and foot.
The venom sinks in. Percy takes his coat, knowing there's nothing else he can say.
Take care of her for me.
Percy spares one last look at Mary's frail form before leaving. Claire sits on the edge of the bed and strokes Mary's hair and jumps when Mary suddenly speaks.
He's growing up so fast.
What did you say?
He must be almost 2 now. He was running fast enough to chase you.
Mary, darling, you must try to get some sleep. Promise.
Mary weakly nods. Claire kisses Mary's head and leaves. For a few seconds, Mary seems to fall asleep until she bolts up from the bed, retching. Her body convulses as she spits something into her hand. A beetle. It lies still, covered in slick saliva. She leans in to examine it. Then its legs twitch. Before she can react, the beetle scutters away, down the bed, across the wooden floor, underneath the door, and disappearing beyond it. Opening credit, Darkling. Act 1. Exterior St. Pancras Cemetery, night. A lone watchman sits at the entrance, trying to fight off sleep. He slowly starts nodding off, when a cloth sack is thrown around his face. The watchman lets out muffled screams as a hand stifles him. Then, just as quickly, the sack is ripped back off. The watchman gasps, then sees his attackers, a group of resurrectionists, body snatchers, doubled over in laughter. He eyes the well-armed men with familiar annoyance.
Shouldn't sleep on the job. I heard there's some bad sorts around here.
Damn you blasted lot.
So, where are the lovelies today?
Sighing, the watchman points at a nearby lot.
Them's three all fresh.
The watchman returns to his post. He keeps his back turned to the resurrectionists as they go about their craft. Series of shots. Soil is shoveled onto the canvas laid over the grave. One end of the wooden coffin is visible. It's propped open with a crowbar. Holes are drilled on the top lid, then threaded with the rope. Some men pull on the rope while others stand over the grave. The combined pressure snaps the coffin with a crack. The lead resurrectionist pokes his head into the grave, illuminating it with his lantern.
Fear not, then, spirit. Death's disrobing hand. 'Tis but the voyage of a darksome hour, the transient gulf dream of a startling sleep.
Interior, Covenant Garden Salon, evening. Percy clears his throat, trying to hide his obvious nerves.
For what thou art shall perish utterly, but what is thine may never cease to be.
There's an awkward silence, followed by a stammering of polite applause. Percy swallows back his disappointment at the meager crowd. About a dozen patrons scattered around a tiny poetry salon, displaying varying degrees of disinterest. There's only one enthusiastic attendee, Percy's wife, Harriet, 21. Her warm and supportive smile only make things worse. Interior Government Garden Salon, evening later. Harriet sits by a pile of Percy's books, waiting for the patrons to buy one on their way out. No one does. Percy finally comes to shove the books back into a crate.
Perhaps there will be others.
It's late. Come.
Percy offers his hand and helps Harriet get up. She grimaces as she does. She's heavily pregnant.
You should have stayed home.
Oh, you know very well I won't miss a reading of yours. Well, it's the only time you let me hear your work.
Well, then, perhaps you can get yourself a copy of Selected Poems by Percy Bysshe Shelley.
Harriet laughs as they pack up the last of the books.
My apologies, Mr. Shelley.
Percy reluctantly turns to find a tall, distinguished-looking man, Fletcher, 40s. Harriet brightens up.
I wanted to attend your reading, but it appears I am late.
Yes, you and the rest of London.
We are so glad you came, Mr.
Fletcher. I'm sorry I missed it. My employer is a great admirer of Mr. Shelley and wants me to convey his compliments.
Oh, how wonderful. Do you work in publishing, Mr. Fletcher?
No, I serve Lord Byron.
Harriet immediately turns cold. Percy notices.
As a matter of fact, he is very keen on making Mr. Shelley's acquaintance to discuss his work.
I'm afraid my husband is otherwise engaged.
Of course. Perhaps another time.
Harriet gives him a curt nod and turns to leave. As Percy follows behind with his chest full of unsold books...
Lord Byron is very interested in your other work as well, Mr. Shelley. If you ever change your mind, he would very much like to discuss it with you.
Percy stops just long enough for both Harriet and Fletcher to notice before following Harriet out the door. Interior, Westbrook Mansion, bedroom, night. Harriet is at her vanity getting ready to sleep. She glimpses through the mirror at Percy as he sulks in bed. She tries to mask her unease with a casual tone.
What did that man mean when he mentioned your other work?
I don't know.
Percy, please.
I promised you that I'd give it up, and I have. What more do you want? Is my word not enough for you?
Of course. I just hate the thought of you having anything to do with that wicked Byron.
He may be ill-reputed, but he's also the most famed poet in Europe. If he could help bring attention to my work...
Percy, have I ever once asked you to put food on the table? To put clothes on my back? My family will support you as long as it takes, but we must do it the righteous way, the godly way. Promise me you'll keep away from that man. Please.
If that's what you want.
Thank you.
Relieved, Harriet sits beside Percy and offers her hand. As soon as he takes it, she closes her eyes and starts to pray. Off Percy's obvious discomfort, prelap, a thunderous echoing applause. Interior Drury Lane Theater, night. A packed audience leaps to their feet, showering applause on a tall figure on stage, sitting on a stool. Lord George Gordon Byron, 28. With a bemused smile, he raises a finger and the entire room falls quiet. Behind him is a poster, Child Harold's Child Harold's Pilgrimage by Lord Byron. The illustration captures the character Harold, with more than a resemblance to Byron, in dark, brooding repose.
A young a female, young and fair, fresh as a nursing mother in whose vein the blood is nectar, but what doth she there, with her unmantled neck and bosom white and bare?
Some of the women lean forward, enraptured, while others sink into their seat, feeling faint at the handsome poet's words.
No, he shall not expire, while in those warm and lovely veins the fire rises.
Exterior, Drury Lane Theater, night. Byron is mobbed as he exits the theater, with several women vying for his attention. But there's another commotion.
Pervert!
A throng of Christian protesters has gathered. They rush at Byron, but clash with his fans instead, causing a melee. One manages to grab Byron by his lapels and shout in his face.
If a man shall take his sister and see her nakedness, and she sees his nakedness, it is a wicked thing.
Startled, Byron cranes his neck and spots Fletcher waiting for him with the carriage. He tries to shake off the persistent protester whose wide, crazed eyes bore into his.
He hath uncovered his sister's nakedness, and he shall bear his iniquity.
Interior carriage night. Byron manages to jump into his carriage, but before he can close the door, a female figure slips in beside him. Byron barely suppresses his disdain when he realizes it's Claire.
I'm afraid you've lost your touch, my Lord Byron. You used to draw far larger rides than this.
Byron raps the ceiling, and the carriage takes off, leaving the ruckus behind. Claire sidles up to Byron, who quickly moves to open the partition and speak to Fletcher.
Any luck with Mr. Shelley?
No, my lord. He sends his regrets.
Byron shuts the partition and sits back, disappointed. Claire calculates his reaction and not so casually notes,
that sanctimonious shrew of a wife won't let Percy anywhere near you, and her claws are in him for good.
Why is that, Miss Claire?
I thought he'd be rid of her when my sister had his child, yet he ran right back to her.
No, I want to know. What does his wife have to do with meeting me?
Claire smiles. She's got him hooked now.
I thought you'd done your research. Her people are religious. Complete fanatics. If they could even bear to be near a man like you, they would have joined the crowd outside the theater just now.
Byron mulls over this, much to Claire's amusement.
So, where would you like to take me?
It's late. However, if you don't have any engagements, I'd like to see you tomorrow evening.
Claire shrugs off her disappointment.
I'm prepared to be impressed.
I only need one small favor.
Interior London apartment night. A figure stirs from the small bed. It's Mary. She stares around the bare, dimly lit room. Beside the bed and the table, there's only an empty crib. Mary walks over to the crib and picks up the baby blanket. She inhales the scent and is nearly bowled over by grief. She slides to the floor, clutching the blanket to her chest, and sees something glinting underneath the table. She reaches over and holds the object up to the candle. It's a dark bottle with a label. Laudanum, caution, poison. Mary turns the bottle over in her hand, considering until she hears footsteps climbing the stairs outside. She rushes to bed, hides the bottle under her pillow, and feigns sleep. Moments later, the door opens, revealing Claire.
Mary, are you asleep?
Mary screws her eyes shut and doesn't respond. Claire leans over to kiss Mary's forehead, while Mary has one arm tucked under her pillow, gripping the laudanum bottle. Prelap, the cracking of a whip, again and again and again. Interior Westbrook Mansion, closet, day. A large, hunched man is on his knees. John Westbrook, 50s, stern and powerful. His naked back is covered with open scars and beads of blood. He whispers a prayer as he thrashes himself with a cat of nine tails. As the leather cracks against his skin, he lets out a relieved sigh, a mortification of the flesh. A closet door creaks open. Harriet enters with a basin and a towel. She takes in Westbrook's exposed, scourged back. He lets out a hiss as she presses the towel against his skin.
Thank you, my dear.
Interior Westbrook Mansion, dining room, evening. Westbrook is all cleaned up, half listening as Harriet chatters on. Percy picks at his food.
And we are hoping to have another reading for Percy next month.
These readings have not amounted to much, have they?
It's not about the money, Father. Percy is making a name for himself among very influential circles.
There's no use in a man's name if he can't get by on his own merit.
Well, a gentleman expressed keen interest in my work last night.
The literary editor?
Harriet shoots Percy a panicked look, but he pushes ahead.
No, he works for Lord Byron.
A deadly silence. Westbrook sets his fork down.
I am aware of his disreputable stature, but given his influence...
Harriet, leave us for a moment.
Father.
He only answers with silence. Harriet spares one last look at Percy before leaving, and all pretense of politeness disappears from Westbrook's face.
I let you keep at this hobby of yours because my daughter enjoys it, and what she wants, she gets. But enough is enough.
You say a man must get by on his own. I'm trying to do
that. While you're under my roof, you will bed my daughter. Sire her children, give them your name, which is the only thing of value you own. That's all. Is that clear?
Interior, Westbrook Mansion, foyer, evening. Percy rushes out of the room and is stopped by Harriet.
Percy, what is it?
Percy puts on his coat, avoiding her gaze. She grabs his arm.
Where are you going? Tell me. Are you going to her? Percy, I swear, if you go to her...
He shakes free of her grasp. She clutches her pregnant belly as he storms out of the door without once looking back.
Percy, wait, please!
Interior London apartment, evening. Mary lies in bed, watching as Claire gets ready to head out.
Lord Byron insisted on you joining us. He will be sorely disappointed.
I'm certain you can entertain him on your own.
Claire leans to kiss Mary's head, and she sees the laudanum bottle poking out from under the pillow. She pretends not to see it.
Perhaps next time, then.
Mary waits until Claire leaves before pulling out the laudanum bottle. She picks up the baby blanket from the crib, inhaling the scent one more time. Something breaks inside of her. Exterior London apartment night. Percy makes his way through the packed street and looks up at Mary's apartment, only to be startled when he sees dark smoke pouring out of the apartment. Interior London apartment night. Percy barges in and is overwhelmed by the thick smoke. Mary is on the floor coughing. Black fumes rise from a saucer of laudanum being heated by candles. Percy quickly extinguishes the flame and tosses the saucer out the window. The smoke slowly dissipates.
Mary, we cannot go on like this.
I don't remember how he smells.
What?
The blanket lost his scent and now I can't smell him anymore.
Mary breaks down into sobs. Percy pulls something out from his waistcoat. A handkerchief monogrammed with M.
I think about him too. Every single day, but you are killing yourself.
I saw him. Right there. I could almost hold him in my arms.
I can't lose you too, Mary. All we have is each other.
He must be almost two now. He was chasing Claire through the fields.
Percy takes in Mary's wide, feverish eyes and holds her tightly, choking back his own tears. She clings to him.
I want to see him again, Percy.
You will. I'll fix it, I promise.
Exterior East End slums night. Fletcher stops his carriage before an unmarked door. Claire steps out, taking in an unseemly sight. Prostitutes and sailors milling about the filth-strewn, dimly lit alleyways. She turns back, confused, but the carriage is gone. Interior auction house night. Claire's eyes adjust to the dark, crowded room. She can make out an auctioneer standing before a packed audience.
Going once, going twice, sold!
Claire presses in for a closer look, but staggers back in horror when she realizes what the lot being auctioned is. It's a naked corpse. It's wheeled away in a barrow.
You did ask me to impress you.
Claire jumps. She turns to find Byron, amused at her shock.
What is this place?
Byron escorts Claire through the crowd. She shivers as he presses against her, whispering into her ear.
The only place in London for both men of science and the occult.
Spotting an older gentleman.
Head of surgery at Guy's Hospital.
Spotting a strange cloaked man.
A Rosicrucian alchemist, I believe.
I'm charmed, but these bodies...
The resurrectionists provide a crucial service. It's a grisly trade, but someone has to do it.
They watch as a new group, the resurrectionist we met earlier, brings a small wheelbarrow to the stage.
Next up, boy, about two, no physical wounds, we'll start at 2 guineas.
The crowd groans. Byron leans in to whisper to Claire again.
Children are not favored here. Their bodies can't withstand much.
Any bids? 2 guineas? Anyone?
A shadowy figure raises his hand from the corner of the room. Claire and Byron turn to get a look of the bidder, but both are shocked when they realize that it's Percy. Interior Westbrook Mansion, parlor night. Harriet stares out of the dark window, frozen in wait. She suddenly reaches for her coat, waking the dozing maid.
Ma'am?
I'm bringing my husband home.
It's too late, ma'am. There's hardly a cab out.
I'll find one by the park.
Harriet heads out, leaving behind the stunned maid. Interior East End shed night. A heavily locked door creaks open. Percy carries in a cloth sack and looks around the small shed with his lantern. Shelves and boxes are covered with canvas, with a fine layer of dust over everything. Percy pulls the canvas aside. There's all manner of occult and scientific devices, burners, crucibles, leather-bound tomes with strange symbols. Percy places the cloth sack on top of the table. With some hesitation, he opens it, revealing the boy's corpse. He lays the body out on the table with care. He grabs a rag, soaks it in alcohol, and starts rubbing down the boy's body. He picks up a scalpel, and he presses it into the skin. He looks into the boy's lifeless face and breaks down. He lays the scalpel down, crying alone in the darkness. Exterior East End shed night. Byron and Claire watch Percy from outside through a small crack in the wall. Claire looks away, shocked and saddened, while Byron presses closer, more intrigued than ever. Exterior Hyde Park night. The park lies in eerie stillness, with only a few lampposts lighting the cobbled path. Harriet is utterly alone. Across the lake, Serpentine, Harry can see cabs and pub-goers on the other side. Relieved, she plunges ahead. Still, she has the nagging feeling that someone or something is behind her. She stops and turns. There's nothing. She starts again, quickening her step, but she can't resist the impulse to look behind her one last time. She does. Before she can scream, something grabs her in the darkness. End of Act 1. Act 2. Exterior St. Pancras Cemetery dawn. The same watchman from before stirs in his post, having slept through yet another watch. He looks out onto the cemetery. The graves seem undisturbed, except for a cloth sack left out on the ground. The watchman gingerly approaches and opens the sack. He jumps back in shock when he realizes it's a child's body. The same one the resurrectionists took and sold to Percy. Exterior Westbrook Mansion day. Percy hesitates before the house, screwing up the courage to face Harriet. He does his best to brush off his clothes. Interior Westbrook Mansion foyer day. The house is eerily quiet. Percy looks around, immediately sensing that something is wrong.
Harriet?
Percy hears footsteps and turns to find Westbrook accompanied by two people, the imposing city magistrate and a constable.
What's happened here?
Westbrook flies across the room to knock Percy down and leaps onto him, punctuating each word with a sickening punch.
You damned monster!
Percy tries to shield himself as the constable struggles with Westbrook, who is finally pulled off, weeping and shaking.
Where is Harriet?
Mrs. Shelley was found dead in the Serpentine this morning.
It's a punch to the gut. Percy turns for confirmation to Westbrook, who refuses to look at him.
That's impossible.
Mr. Shelley, can you tell us what happened yesterday evening?
Dread sinks in as Percy realizes he can't tell the truth.
I had a disagreement with my wife and left
the
house.
Where did you spend the night?
With my mistress.
Miss Mary Goodwin? When we spoke with her today, she said she was under the impression that you returned here. Now, why would that be?
I do not know.
He's a madman and an occultist. My daughter tried to change him for the better, and he killed her.
John, you must believe me. I would never hurt your daughter.
Westbrook collapses into tears.
You will burn in hell for this.
John, please, listen to me.
Mr. Shelley, I'm afraid we must hold you until the inquest.
Please, you don't understand. I didn't do this.
Percy wrestles with the constable, who grabs him by the arm and begins to drag him away.
No. Please, listen to me. I didn't kill my wife. Please.
Interior London apartment day. Mary sits with Claire, shaking and nearly catatonic.
This is not your fault.
His wife is dead, Claire. I want to go back before all of this happened, before Percy...
But you love him.
More than anything.
Claire nods. She holds Mary's face and wipes away her tears.
You'd do anything for him, wouldn't you?
Flashback. 2. Interior London apartment night. Flashback. Percy works by candlelight at a desk littered with paper and manuscripts. He scribbles into his book, while before him, a squeaking mouse trembles in its cage. Percy observes the mouse, which twitches and tries to hide. He inserts a metal rod through the bars of the cage and pokes at the mouse, which sends the creature into electric shock. Percy times the convulsions and notes them down. The mouse goes still.
Percy?
Mary stirs from bed. Beside her is baby William, sleeping in his crib. Mary looks healthy and rosy, unrecognizably so.
I'll be a minute, dear.
Mary instead comes to look over his shoulder at his work.
A proper madman you are.
As I recall, when we met, you were very impressed by my knowledge of galvanism and occultism.
Yes, but back then you were only writing poetry about it, not toying with dead animals in our home.
Alas, this is now your burden.
Percy kisses Mary, then leans over to kiss William's head.
Come to bed soon.
I will.
Yawning, Percy turns back to the still mouse and pokes it with the electric rod. It doesn't move. He lights up a small crucible and pours a few drops of the dark tincture. It's laudanum. As he watches dark smoke curl up, his eyes start rolling back, exposing their whites. Interior London apartment night later. Percy blinks awake in a haze of light and noise. As he drowsily gains consciousness, he realizes the desk is on fire. Black smoke has filled the entire room. Mary is shaking him by the arms, trying to get him up.
Percy, we need to go!
Percy lurches out of the chair, unsteady on his feet. Mary scoops William into her arms and pushes Percy out the door. Exterior London apartment night. A small crowd has gathered. The fire seems to have gone out, but the thick smoke continues to spill from within. Percy watches in a drugged daze as a group of men push past him and run into the building with pails of water. He turns around and is surprised to see Mary on the cold ground, clutching William and sobbing in distress.
Mary, what is it?
You won't wake.
What?
She finally looks at him. Her eyes are wide, manic.
He won't wake up.
Percy tears William out of her arms. He finally gets a look at his son's face. Gray, pallid, dead.
No. No, no, no!
Percy shakes William, gently at first, then with increasing desperation, Mary sobs into her hands, screaming.
What have you done, Percy?
I can fix this! I can fix this!
She grabs William back out of Percy's arms.
This is your doing!
It was an accident!
You killed my son! Don't you dare touch
him! Mary, please!
You did this, my son! My son!
Percy staggers to his feet. He takes in the sight, his mistress on the ground, clutching their son's lifeless body, and the crowd of neighbors gathered around them, watching him with hateful judgment. He turns and runs away. Exterior Westbrook Mansion, dawn. The door opens to reveal the maid and a frosty Harriet.
You shouldn't be here.
Her cold demeanor melts away when she realizes the wretched state Percy is in.
Percy, what's happened to you?
Despite herself, Harriet rushes over to Percy as he collapses before her, breaking into sobs.
It was all my fault.
What was? What happened?
It was all my fault. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
Back to interior London jail cell, night. Back to present. Percy twitches in his nightmares, huddled into a sweaty heap on the jail floor. The other cells are filled with drunks, prostitutes, pimps, all sizing up their unlikely arrival. The door to Percy's cell slides open. Percy doesn't look up as the guard impatiently taps the metal bars.
The magistrate says you can go.
Percy doesn't move. The guard picks him up by the lapels, pulling him up to his feet. Interior London jail holding area, night, and shoves him out of the cell. Percy, feverish and unsteady, stumbles before the magistrate, who skeptically looks him up and down.
Mr. Shelley, it seems this gentleman can vouch for your whereabouts last night. You are free to go for now.
Percy turns about, coming face to face with Byron, who is accompanied by another man, Dr. John Polidori, 23, brooding and serious.
I will escort you to your home, Mr. Shelley.
Percy's knees buckle, and he falls in a sickly faint. Interior carriage day. A carriage trudges along. Lying across the seat, Percy barely registers as Byron and Polidori confer in a whisper. Percy's body is carried out of the cab and into another. There's water outside the window, then trees. Byron holds Percy's head up as Polidori forces a liquid down his throat. Polidori listens to Percy's heartbeat with a stethoscope. Byron watches with intensity. Percy sleeps fitfully, his fever now broken. Exterior Lake Geneva, day. The carriage drives along the lake. It's calm but dark, reflecting the overcast sky. Interior carriage day. Percy sits up and looks out the window. He still seems pale and withdrawn, but much better than before.
I hope you're feeling well, Shelley. Dr. Polidori here worked tirelessly to knit you back to life. Isn't that right, Polly?
I was glad to help, Mr. Shelley.
Forgive me, but where are we going?
We're going to my estate in Geneva.
Switzerland? That can't be. I have to go back.
Exterior. Villa Diodati, day. An imposing Baroque mansion looms by the water. A befuddled Percy watches as uniformed servants pull open the iron-wrought gates for the carriage to pass through. Interior, Villa Diodati, foyer day. Percy takes in a stately, luxurious villa as the servants carry in Byron's luggage.
I hope you find it to your liking.
Lord Byron, I am immeasurably grateful for your assistance, but I must return to England at once.
Nonsense, we've just arrived, and you've barely recovered
from indebted to you and Dr. Polidori, but I beg your leave.
Percy?
Percy whirls around, stunned to find Mary and Claire walking down the grand staircase. He's caught even more off guard when Mary rushes into his arms. Exterior, Villa Diodati, grounds day. Mary and Percy stroll by the lake, taking in the chill air.
Claire and Lord Byron promised we'd be safe here until things calmed down back home.
You should stay, but I must return and find out what happened to Harriet. I owe her at least that.
If they find you guilty, they could hang you for it.
Mary, for all the time we've been together, we've had to confine ourselves to the shadows. I can't bear to hide any longer. I must clear my name for both our sakes.
Mary takes Percy's hand.
I thought I couldn't go on after losing William. When Claire told me you were taken away, the thought of being in this world without you, I wouldn't be able to survive it.
What we've done...
We'll pay for it in time, but now, stay with me, please.
Percy considers their hands clasped together and nods. Relieved, Mary buries herself in his chest. He holds her tightly before pulling her in for a kiss, tentative at first, but filled with new promise. Interior, Villa Diodati, Byron's room, night. Outside the window, rain besieges the lake. Byron in his desk writes a letter. There's a knock. When he answers the door, he's not surprised to find Claire in a sheer nightgown and nothing else.
My lord Byron, the rain gave me such a fright.
Byron sighs and steps aside. Claire bounds in, giddy. Interior Villa Diodati, Mary's room, night. Mary sleeps fitfully as a drop of water hits her face. She tries to ignore it, but it continues. Drip, drip. She wipes at her face and stirs awake, opening her eyes just as a flash of lightning reveals Harriet, standing over her bed. Mary scrambles away, too terrified to even scream. Harriet is a ghoulish vision, water dripping down her half-decomposed face, seaweed tangled up in her hair, her torn gown revealing a bloody gash on her stomach. Harriet draws nearer, trying to say something. She grabs Mary's wrist, her pale fingers caked in mud. Interior Villa Diodati, Byron's room, night. Claire moans in pleasure as Byron roughly pushes into her. They roll in a mess of sweaty, tangled limbs until they hear Mary's unmistakable scream.
What was that?
Byron quickly untangles himself from Claire. They stumble out of the bed and throw on their clothes, and Byron grabs a pistol. Interior Villa Diodati, hallway, night. Byron leads Claire down the dark hallway, lamp in one hand and gun in the other. Polidori runs to meet them.
Was that Miss Mary?
Byron gestures at Mary's door. They burst in, gun drawn, and find Mary sitting on the floor in a pool of water while a concerned Percy tries to comfort her. Rain blows through the open window, the sheer curtains billowing as the wooden panels thud in an unsettling rhythm. Interior Villa Diodati, Mary's room, night. Polidori examines Mary while she trembles under a blanket.
It's only nerves. Here, this will help you sleep.
Polidori offers Mary a bottle of ether. She shakes her head.
But she was right here. I saw her.
The servants have turned down the house upside down. There's no one here.
It was Harriet. She was all bloody and she kept mentioning a baby. Her belly was split open. I couldn't stand to look at it.
Shh, it was a bad dream. I'm here now.
Percy soothes Mary until her panic subsides. Polidori offers her the ether again, and she reluctantly takes it. Exterior Villa Diodati, Mary's room, night later. Mary leans against a sleeping Percy, listening to the rain. She turns over her waist, afraid of what she might find, and sees a handprint, branded red, into her pale skin, exactly where Harriet clutched her. Exterior Guy's Hospital Mortuary, night. A coroner tries to show a pleading Westbrook out the door.
Please. I only want a decent burial for my daughter.
The law's the law. Once the police rule a suicide, we have to bury her in the Potter's Field.
My daughter did not kill herself. She was murdered.
You can take it up with the magistrate, sir, but I can't help you. I'm sorry.
The coroner shuts the door. Westbrook breaks down, crying. Interior Guy's Hospital Mortuary, night. The coroner walks back to the work table, where a body lies underneath a bloodied sheet. A tall figure approaches. Fletcher. He hands the coroner a pouch.
That's it, then. I'm washing my hands of this nasty business.
Fletcher peels back the bloodied sheet. It's Harriet.
I thought she drowned.
Eventually.
He draws closer for a look at Harriet's pale, still face. Perplexed, he lifts up the rest of the sheet and sees a large gash running across Harriet's stomach.
Where is her baby?
End of Act 2. Act 3. Interior Villa Diodati, Mary's room, day. Mary stirs awake, finding herself alone. The storm seems to have passed, but dark clouds still loom above the lake. Interior Villa Diodati, parlor, day. Mary slips into the room and finds the others entranced by Byron as he paces and reads from a slim book.
I turn to awake one of the children, but no powers can depict the horrors I endured when I saw the frightful figure at the side of the child's bed,
Byron
covered...
Byron lunges towards Claire, prompting her to jump and laugh.
What is this?
Phantasmagoriana. It's a collection of German ghost stories.
Ghastly stuff, that's what it is, but at least it fits the weather.
Byron hands it to Mary. She flips through it, unimpressed.
Evil portraits and family curses.
You don't believe in ghost stories?
Perhaps I would if they were better written than this.
Percy and Polidori laugh, but Byron looks at her intent.
You believe we can do better? Now there's an idea.
He takes the book back from Mary.
I did not mean to offend you.
We will each write a ghost story. The more gruesome, the better.
A contest?
Yes, we will share our stories and judge who amongst us is the most capable of terrifying the others.
Count me in.
I'll do it for a laugh, Percy.
Well, we've nothing better to do.
How about you, Miss Mary? Are you up for the challenge?
They all turn to Mary, expectant. She hesitates.
I don't feel up to writing, but I'll be happy to judge.
Percy seems disappointed. Byron looks out the window at the gray but clear sky.
Perhaps we can change your mind. But since the storm has passed, how about we go out on the lake for now?
Exterior Villa Diodati, docks day. Byron strolls with Percy and Claire while Mary and Polidori trail behind. A servant follows at a discreet distance. Byron gestures at the servant to prepare one of the rowboats.
I'll take this one.
I happen to be a pretty good rower.
Marvelous. You can take the other boat, and I'll take Shelley.
Mary, will you join us?
Oh, I'll stay. Enjoy yourselves.
Byron gets in the boat and helps Percy in. They row away while the servant helps a fuming Claire into the other one. Exterior Lake Geneva day. Percy closes his eyes as he rows, the distress of the past few days melting away for a moment. When he reopens them, he finds Byron watching closely.
I really am glad you came, Shelley.
Forgive me for asking, but why did you bring us here? Is it because of your friendship with Claire?
Byron scoffs.
I wouldn't use that word. Look, she visited the theater often, and I was exceedingly persistent. I've endeavored to keep our acquaintance brief. Then I discovered her connection to you.
Why did you invite me here, then?
I'm a great admirer of your work.
You read my poetry?
No. Your other work.
Exterior Villa Diodati, docks day. Gloomy clouds gather in the distance. Mary watches Percy and Byron's boat drift further away, while Claire and the servant's boat lingers by the shore. Exterior Lake Geneva, day. Percy turns cold. Both men have stopped rowing.
I'm not certain what you mean.
You're an alchemist.
A moment, and Percy laughs.
I didn't take you for a suspicious man.
I read your novella, Secret Alchemy Turns to Potable Gold from the... I read your novella, Secret Alchemy Turns to Potable Gold, the poisonous waters which flow from the death through life.
That was a metaphor for poetry.
It strips the veil of familiarity from the world and lays bare the naked and sleeping beauty, which is the spirit of its forms.
You have misunderstood me. I don't know why you brought me here, but I cannot help you.
I saw you at the Resurrectionists. You bought the child.
Percy freezes.
I don't know what answers you were seeking there, but I believe they are the same as mine.
Exterior Villa Diodati, docks evening. Mary walks to the lake's edge and peers down. It's too murky to make out anything, but as light fades over, it seems to reveal dark, inky shapes dancing in its depths.
Careful, Miss Mary.
She snaps out of her reverie to find the doctor beside her.
You almost fell in.
Thank you.
Mary goes back to watching the boats, but it's clear that Polidori wants to engage her.
I apologize if you hear this often, but I'm a great admirer of both your parents.
Thank you.
What a gift it is to inherit such an illustrious legacy. I heard you're also a writer. I happen to dabble in writing myself.
I don't write anymore.
Why is that?
Mary's eyes remain on the small boat bobbing in the middle of the lake, and Percy and Byron's distant silhouettes.
It's getting too dark.
I'm certain that they are fine.
An apparition appears in the sky, a bolt of lightning. It hangs in the sky for a moment, cleaving the sky in two, and then a roll of thunder. It's as though the sky has cracked open. Mary and Polidori jump away from the water's edge. They can barely make out the servant rowing Claire back in a hurry.
You should come inside.
I'll wait for Percy.
Exterior Lake Geneva evening. The two men scramble for their oars and start rowing. The shore looks impossibly distant. Percy looks over to get his bearing and sees something beckoning him in the roiling water. Percy leans in, trying to make out the mysterious shape.
Shelley, what are you doing?
The shape draws him closer and closer until the boat hits a particularly big wave, hurling Percy into the stormy lake.
Shelley!
Exterior Villa Diodati, docks night. Claire and the servant reach Mary just as Percy falls in.
Percy!
She tries to run towards the boat, but is restrained by Polidori. She strains against him to no avail.
We have to get him! Let me go!
Exterior Lake Geneva, underwater night. Percy whirls about in blind panic, trying to get his bearing. Gasping for air, he claws at the water, but then lightning illuminates a pair of arms wrapping around him. Percy punches and kicks at the phantom figure, but it holds on tighter. He chokes water into his already pounding lungs. He looks up to see the bolts of lightning dancing on the other side of the water. His eyes gradually blink closed, giving way to blissful unconsciousness until, interior Villa Diodati parlor night, he gasps awake, coughing up lake water into a pan. He's on the floor by a crackling fire covered in blankets. Mary holds him while Polidori checks his pulse.
He's fine.
Percy coughs up more water while Mary rubs his back.
There was someone in the water. These arms, they grabbed me.
Yes, I'm afraid that was me.
Percy turns to find Byron reclining in his robe, looking completely unaffected, save for his wet hair and the bruises on his neck and his chest. Claire is by Byron's side, looking at him in adoration.
You're very lucky Lord Byron is such an excellent swimmer, Percy.
No harm done.
Although I can't begin to fathom how a fellow who loves boating can't swim at all.
Well, you have my deepest gratitude.
Percy tries to sit up, but dissolves into a coughing fit. Polidori gives Percy a glass of ether.
This will relax your lungs, but I'd like to have you stay in my room tonight for observation.
Good. I believe we've all had enough excitement for one evening.
Interior of Illidiati, hallway night. Mary hesitates before her room. Claire bounds up behind her.
Claire, will you stay with me?
Don't tell me you're still scared. It was only a bad dream, silly.
I suppose you have better offers for bed partners?
Claire nudges her away and heads towards Byron's room. Mary opens the door to take her own, taking in the unwelcome sight of the cavernous bed and the dark, wide windows. Interior, Villadiodati, Byron's room night. Claire slips into Byron's room and immediately frowns. His bed is empty, and there's no trace of him anywhere. Claire makes herself comfortable in bed, waiting. Interior, Villadiodati, Polidori's room night. Percy turns fitfully in his makeshift bed. He finally stirs, only to find Byron sitting across from him, watching him.
What do you do?
Byron puts a finger over his lips and gestures at Polidori, who sleeps in his bed a few feet away. Byron hands Percy a cloak and motions at him to follow. Exterior, Villadiodati, grounds night. Percy staggers after Byron, who leads the way with a lantern. Both of them are buffeted by the heavy winds.
Byron, where are we going?
They stop before an unremarkable shed. Byron fiddles with the lock before heaving the heavy door open. Interior, Villadiodati, laboratory night. Byron uses the lantern to light a torch on the wall. As it illuminates the dark room, Percy realizes that it's actually a laboratory, crammed with beakers and other chemical apparatuses. Glass jars filled with suspended fetuses, shelves of leather tomes covered with occult signs and symbols. It's a far cry from Percy's shed. There's a part of Percy that wants to run around exploring everything, but he suppresses it.
Byron, I told you I'm not interested in whatever it is you are involved with.
What were your thoughts when you were in the water? When you thought you were about to take your last breath?
I didn't think anything. I swam.
I was in the water with you. You didn't swim up towards the air. You saw something and you followed it.
I don't know what you think you know about me, but I want no part of this. Is that clear?
There's just one thing I want to show you. If you are still firm about your decision, I won't press the subject ever again. I promise.
Percy hesitates, but nods. Byron heads towards an icebox covered in thick chains. He unlocks the chains and opens it. A human figure rests underneath a blanket of ice. Byron nods at him to go closer. Percy leans in towards the corpse's still face, rising out of the ice, and realizes it's Harriet. Percy staggers away, horrified, especially when he sees the gash running across her stomach.
Byron, where? How did you...
She's been preserved in perfect condition for you.
She looks just as Mary described in her dream. But that's not possible.
Byron grips him by the shoulder, eyes burning.
The moment I read your words, I understood. You and I are kindred spirits, unafraid to peel back the layer and look into the unknown. The dark ages of superstition and fear will pass once we prove that science conquers death, that man defies God. Isn't that what you've been looking for all this time?
I can't. This is not right.
Think of all the lives you have saved. You could have saved your wife's, your child's. This is how we make our amends, Shelley. Not by looking backwards, but into the future.
She's my wife, Byron.
And now she's dead. But perhaps she won't need to stay that way. Will you bury her in the ground, or will you give her another chance at life?
Percy stares at the table, torn. Harriet's face is turned to him as though she's waiting for an answer.
Show me what you've done so far.
End of Act 3. Act 4. Interior Godwin residence, drawing room day. Flashback. Percy reads a poem under the vigilant watch of Sir William Godwin. 50s, intimidating and austere. Mary and Claire. The girls listen to the dashing young poet with open lust, which doesn't escape Sir William's notice. Interior Godwin resident hallway, day. Percy is pounced on by a waiting Mary, barely 16 and already too bold and bright to be ignored.
I quite enjoyed your poem.
I'm glad, Miss Mary. But you promised me you'd write me one.
I've tried, but I can't seem to find my inspiration. Where do you find yours, Mr. Shelley?
Well, sometimes I have assistance.
He holds up an amber vial. She comes closer for a look.
Laudanum. It transports you to a different world. Shows you your heart's desires.
Oh, I don't know if I should.
Percy squeezes a few drops into his mouth, never taking his eyes off from Mary. Before he can swallow, she pulls him into a hungry kiss, drinking in the laudanum. When she opens her eyes, she's suddenly in exterior, St. Pancras Cemetery evening, holding hands with Percy before a gravestone. It reads, Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin.
Why did you bring me here?
I wanted you to meet my mother. I'm with your child, Percy.
After a moment, Percy pulls her in for an embrace.
You're not angry.
Of course not.
Your wife.
We can finally be a proper family.
They kiss until it grows more insistent and urgent. But as Mary falls onto the grass, she's distracted by something. The sound of a crying baby nearby. Mary stops.
What is it?
She follows the noise to the other side of the cemetery, where two grave diggers shovel dirt onto a fresh grave. With growing dread, Mary walks back up to the edge of the grave and sees a squirming, crying baby at the bottom.
No. Stop. Stop it.
The grave diggers continue. She tries to grab their shovels.
Stop. You're killing it.
She lunges at the grave, but the grave diggers restrain her.
Oh, let me go. He's still alive.
Her words are suddenly cut off as 100 writhing baby arms shoot out of the grave and drag her down. The baby's cries grow louder and louder until we cut back to Interior Villa Diodati, Mary's room, night, present. Mary gasps as she snaps awake. She turns to find that Percy is gone. Confused, she's about to open the door, but the thunder draws her to the window. Through the storm, she spots two hooded figures on the ground, heading toward the villa, Percy and Byron. Interior, Villa Diodati, Byron's room, day. Claire wakes up in Byron's bed to the sound of vomiting. Byron emerges from the washroom, wiping his mouth. Polidori follows behind, carrying a small basin.
I see you are comfortable.
Where were you last night?
I fell asleep in the study.
Talking with Percy all night, like little boys, no doubt.
Byron smirks. He lies back on a chaise as Polidori pulls out a small knife and hesitates.
Perhaps this might overwhelm your sensibilities, Miss Claire.
You can certainly try, Doctor.
Polidori shrugs and makes a small incision on Byron's forearm. He collects the drops of blood with the basin. As the blood lets out, Byron takes a long drink of wine.
It's much better.
I suggest resting indoors today. If you do stay in, there's something I've been working on that I would love to share.
Interior, Villa Diodati, parlor evening. The party is gathered around a fire. Polidori is in the thick of it, reading his story with relish. The others seem like they've been held hostage for hours, which they have been.
I dreamt of happiness, but the demon's threats I found had indeed been fulfilled.
Byron dozes off, while the others at least pretend to look like they're paying attention.
Your mother's portrait was Matilda's. You married a daughter of Matilda, and I was the murderer of her father. The end.
Polidori finishes and looks up to his audience, expectant. Byron wakes up and stretches.
Is it time for dinner?
So, the demon killed the wife?
No, the narrator killed his wife, so the demon cursed the family.
But if the narrator was the murderer of her daughter's father, he killed himself?
The curse was about killing the wife's father, not the daughter's. Yeah, I'll read this part again.
Please spare us, Polly.
Claire stifles a giggle. Polidori turns crimson.
Perhaps if you have a suggestion.
My suggestion is that you stick to what you do best, Doctor.
My apologies. I thought you'd at least enjoy the part with the profligate son squandering his family's fortune while seducing his own sister.
Ooh, it's like a shot fired. Everyone turns to Byron, who remains cold and inscrutable. He advances on Polidori as if to punch him, then strides past him towards his room, followed by Claire. Polidori throws his papers down and leaves as well. Interior Villa Diodati, hallway, night. Polidori stalks towards his room, and Mary chases after him.
Doctor, you should take this.
Polidori whirls around, about to snap, then sees that she's holding his discarded manuscript.
The story doesn't quite work, but there are good elements. I like the allusions to Oedipus and Faust.
You did.
Keep working at it.
He takes the papers, profoundly moved by her small kindness. Seized by a sudden impulse, he moves to kiss her, but she dodges out of the way.
I'm sorry.
Good night, Doctor.
Good night, Miss Mary.
He stares after her as she leaves, smitten. Go as well. Interior Villa Diodati, Byron's room, night. Claire slips in as Byron angrily pulls off his clothes.
My lord.
Her breath catches in her throat as she pushes her against the wall, pinning her with his body.
Why are you here?
You seemed upset.
No. Why are you really here?
Is it true, you and your sister?
Does it matter?
No, as long as you care for me.
I don't.
She searches his eyes and only finds cold honesty.
I've done everything for you. I left behind my family. I brought Percy here just as you asked.
This is not only for me, but for us. Do you want to remain the less talented sister of the genius writer? The girl waiting outside of the theater for every famed poet in London? Or do you want more?
I want more.
And you're prepared to do anything?
Claire hesitates, then nods. He pulls her towards him, hungrily tearing at her clothes. Interior Villa Diodati, Mary's room, night. As Mary walks in, Percy quickly puts a piece of paper he's been scribbling on.
What is it you're working on?
Just some verses for Byron's little challenge.
Oh, were you so inspired by Dr. Polidori's recital?
Percy chuckles and starts undressing for bed. Mary hesitates.
Is it true what he said about Lord Byron and his sister?
It's vicious gossip. Nothing more.
The way he responded, it made me think we've been staying at his house for days now, but we know next to nothing about him.
He's been nothing but a gracious host. And as you may recall, it was your idea to stay here.
You're right. By the way, did you go somewhere last night? I woke up and missed you.
I went to the study and fell asleep there by accident. Dearest, enough with these worries. You're making a new start, remember?
Mary nods, Percy pulls her in for a kiss, and they fall into bed, hands fumbling and roaming all over each other, as though they're discovering each other for the first time. Mary buries herself against Percy's neck, her nails digging into her back, never letting go. Interior Villa Diodati, Mary's room, night later. Mary stirs awake, she pushes aside her tangled hair to find Percy is gone again. She falls back against the pillow, frustrated and confused. Interior Villa Diodati, laboratory night. Harriet's body is laid out on a table. Her gray, pallid skin grows strangely under a lit torch. The gash across her stomach has been sewn up. Percy and Byron labor over the corpse, attaching wires all over the body. With a nod, they flip the switch. Exterior, Villa Diodati, grounds, night. Mary is pressed against the grimy window of the laboratory, watching in silent horror as inside, Harriet's body twitches and flails as if it's alive. Percy and Byron look on, their faces filled with hope. Mary turns and runs back to the villa. Interior Villa Diodati, laboratory, night. As soon as the switch is turned off, the limbs fall back onto the table. Disappointed, Percy tosses the switch aside.
Still the same result. The body cannot run without constant electrical input.
We are out of our depths here. Perhaps Polidori
is an idiot with no sense of imagination. Come, help me.
Percy tries to untie one of the leather cuffs restraining the corpse's wrists to the table, but it's stuck. He tugs at it a few times, then frustrated, pulls out a pocket knife. He slices at the hardened leather, but it's tough.
Careful, Shelley.
Percy yelps as the knife cuts both his and the corpse's hands. Crimson blood spills out of Percy's palm, while black, congealed blood oozes out of the corpse's hand as well. Byron rushes over and tries to snatch Percy's bleeding with his handkerchief.
It's only a shallow cut.
Hold still.
Blood seeps through the white handkerchief, and Percy winces.
Damn it, Shelley. That temper of yours will be the end of you.
I deserve it, too.
Byron can see that Percy means it.
Look, we've all done things that we can't take back. I won't presume to know what you've done, nor will I ask you to share your past with me, but there's something I want to tell you as your friend.
What is it?
Self-pity is terribly unattractive on you.
Percy lets out a small laugh. Byron peels back the now-soaked handkerchief, and the blood flow has slowed, but not stopped.
Perhaps I should have Polidori take a look.
Byron seizes Percy's hand and sucks on the wound. He doesn't seem to notice the blood smearing his face, or doesn't seem to mind. His dark eyes remain trained on Percy, who stares back in shock and barely repressed desire. Interior Villa Diodati, Mary's room, night. Percy slips into the room. Mary's in bed, her back turned to him. He gets in bed beside her, kissing her shoulder. Off Mary's quiet, terrified expression as Percy falls asleep next to her. End of Act 4. Act 5. Interior Villa Diodati, Byron's room, day. Polidori knocks and enters with a medical tray. He finds Byron already sitting at his desk, writing.
I have your medicine.
He stops when he sees a sudden movement in bed. It's Claire stirring under the sheets. Oh,
my apologies. I didn't realize.
Claire gets up. Her bare body has bruises and bite marks running down it. Polidori averts his gaze as she throws on her gown and walks past him, her eyes disturbingly blank.
Good morning, Doctor.
Miss Claire.
Byron doesn't look up as she leaves. Polidori busies himself with preparing the medical tincture.
Anything you want to say, Polidori?
No, I wanted to apologize for last night. I was out of line and it won't happen again.
Good.
He takes the tincture and drinks it, followed by wine.
A bit early for that, isn't it?
I pay you to keep me alive, not to play mother.
Polidori bites back a retort and packs his things away.
And on that same token, I suggest you focus on the profession you're paid to do and not the one you aspire to do. You may insult me or imitate me all you want, Polidori, but you'll never be me. Save yourself the effort.
Yes, sir.
Exterior Villa Diodati, Doc's day. Mary wanders out of the house, drawn by a strange sight. Claire standing at the edge of the lake, almost teetering.
Claire?
Mary rushes to her side and pulls her back from the water. Claire turns around, her expression unnaturally impassive.
Thank you, Mary.
You're acting so strange. What's gotten into you?
I don't recall.
Alarmed, Mary grabs Claire and looks into her eyes. It's almost as though a fog has come over her.
Claire, you're frightening me. Tell me, what is it? Something happened with Byron?
Byron? I love him. I should return to him.
Mary watches in distress as Claire turns and heads back to the house as though nothing happened. She takes off after her sister, running into the villa. Interior Villa Diodati, Mary's room day. Mary throws her suitcase open on the bed and starts flinging all her clothes and belongings inside. There's a knock at the door.
Come in.
Polidori walks in, taken aback by the maelstrom.
Are you planning on leaving?
I've had enough of this dreadful place. I can't seem to get through to Percy, but I'm taking Claire with me.
I'm not certain that travel is advisable in your condition.
My condition is fine.
Miss Mary, you're pregnant.
Mary freezes.
That's not possible.
I assure you, you are. When I examined you that first night...
You don't understand. Percy and I haven't... You knew all this time. You didn't tell me.
I assumed that you knew. If you'd like to be alone, I'll take your leave.
Polidori hurries out the door. Mary sits by the half-packed suitcase, feeling numb. She feels her stomach. Interior Villa Diodati, parlor night. Percy, Byron, and Polidori play a card game. Claire is curled up by the window, watching the storm outside. Mary watches from the doorway, fed up with Percy's drunken laughter. She approaches the card table, stopping the game.
Pardon us for a moment.
Interior Villa Diodati, hallway night. Mary pulls a stumbling Percy out of the parlor.
We need to leave, Percy.
What's the matter?
I don't like it here. Too many bad things have happened since we came.
Why are you so upset? What's gone into you?
What's gotten into me? Percy, look at yourself. This isn't the new start we talked about. Please, let's just go anywhere else.
But I so enjoyed being here with my lovely wife.
She squirms as he tries to pull her in close and sees his dilated pupils.
I'm not your wife, Percy. Have you taken laudanum?
Only for the pain.
He holds up his bandaged hand with a sheepish grin. He pulls her in again, but this time she firmly pushes him away. Percy shakes his head and staggers back towards the parlor, and Mary follows him. Interior Villa Diodati, parlor night. Byron is in the midst of another grandiose reading, this time from Coleridge's Christabel.
So halfway from the bed she rose, and on her elbow did recline, to look at the Lady Geraldine.
Claire and Polidori watch in confusion as Percy strides towards Polidori's bag and grabs the bottle of ether. He chugs it down. Mary lingers by the door, unsure of what to do.
Beneath the lamp, the lady bowed and slowly rolled her eyes around. Then, drawing in her breath aloud like one that shuddered, she unbound the cincture from beneath her breast.
Percy finishes the entire bottle. Bleary and dazed, he looks out the window and freezes in horror. Just outside, looking straight into the room, is Harriet, drenched, bleeding, looking straight at him with her empty eyes.
No.
Her silken robe and inner vest drop to her feet, and in full view behold her bosom and half her side.
Percy looks around the room in panic. No one else seems to have noticed anything. They all listen to Byron, enthralled. Harriet beckons him, her decomposing mouth opening to speak.
A sight to dream of, not to tell. Oh, shield her, shield sweet Christabel.
Percy shrieks and collapses to the floor, clutching his head. The others rush towards him in alarm.
Percy!
Get that demon out!
Percy points a trembling finger at where Harriet was, only to find nothing. He shudders, sweaty and feverish.
She was here! She was here!
Interior Villa Diodati, Mary's room night. Percy continues to mumble in fitful sleep. Mary watches as he shakes and twitches, looking like a frightened boy tangled up in the sheets. Polidori packs up his medical bag.
He's had much to drink, but he should be good after a long rest.
Polidori moves toward the door.
Doctor, wait. Are you good with secrets?
Doctors generally are. What do you need?
I need you.
Polidori hesitates, daring himself to hope. Interior Villa Diodati, parlor day. It's raining outside. The party is gathered once more. Everyone looks worn from the night before, except Byron, who preens as he presents a sheaf of paper to the group.
Here is my humble contribution to our gathering. But first, is there anyone else who has written a story?
Percy and Claire shake their heads.
Miss Mary, have you decided to join our little challenge?
Mary is alone by the window, watching the storm.
Yes, I found my story.
Marvelous. You finished it?
No, but I saw it in a dream. I saw a young man, a student. He'd been too clever and ambitious for his own good, and he'd set on a monstrous task to knit together a dead creature and create life.
Percy sits up. Byron's face betrays nothing.
His success would terrify him. He would rush away from his odious handiwork, horror-stricken. He sleeps, but he's awakened. He opened his eyes. Behold, the horrid things strands at his bedside. And so the creature will haunt his crater till the ends of the earth.
Byron is about to speak, but is distracted by the brilliant flash of lightning outside over by the lake. It's followed by a violent crack of thunder. Claire screams. They rush to the window. The air is smoky and it hums with electricity.
It only hit the lake. Come, come, it's nothing.
Everyone gets settled back down. Byron makes his way through the window, pouring everyone a generous glass of wine.
Well, Miss Mary, that does sound like a most terrifying tale. I hope to read it soon.
You will.
My poem is actually about a similar experience as yours. Would you all like to hear it?
I'm certain we would all love to.
Byron smiles and takes center stage. As soon as he does, his demeanor shifts. He's no longer Byron, the magnanimous host, but Byron, the poet and performer. With a low, rumbling voice, he begins.
If I had a dream, which was not at all a dream.
Interior Villa Diodati, laboratory night. Percy and Byron return with a lantern, ready for another night of work. They pause when they realize the icebox containing Harriet's body is gone.
The bright sun was extinguished, and the stars did wander darkling in the eternal space, rayless and pathless.
Exterior Villa Diodati, laboratory night. Flashback. Polidori carries the icebox out of the shed and loads it into a wheelbarrow. He turns to Mary in question, but she just leads him into the darkness. He pushes the wheelbarrow and follows.
And the icy earth swung blind and blackening in the moonless air. Morn came and went and came and brought no day.
Exterior Lake Geneva, night flashback. Polidori and Mary now row into the lake. Their boat is attached by another rope containing the icebox. Once they reach the middle of the lake, Polidori tips the second boat over, spilling the icebox into the water. Mary and Polidori watch the icebox disappear beneath the surface, bound by their secret.
And men forget their passions in the dread of this their desolation, and all hearts were chilled into a selfish prayer for light.
Interior Villa Diodati, parlor day. Polidori watches as Claire plays the piano. As she pauses to turn a page, she sweeps her hair into the side, and he can see two indents on the side of her neck, like tooth marks.
The world was void. The populous and the powerful was a lump, seasonless, herbless, treeless, manless, lifeless, a lump of death. A chaos of hard clay.
Interior Villa Diodati, Byron's room day. Byron stands naked, examining himself in the mirror. He reaches for something, his handkerchief, still stained with Percy's blood. He closes his eyes and inhales the scent.
The rivers, lakes, and ocean all stood still. Nothing stirred within their silent depths. Ships sailorless lay rotting on the sea, and their masts fell down piecemeal.
Interior Villa Diodati, Mary's room day. Mary throws up into a basin. She pushes her hair back from her sweaty brow and feels around in her stomach. Suddenly, she retches into her hand. She pulls it back, expecting to find vomit, but instead, there's a small beetle.
As they dropped, they slept on the abyss without a surge. The waves were dead. The tides were in their grave. The moon, their mistress, had expired before.
Exterior Lake Geneva night. It's finally a clear night. The surface of the lake ripples as a human figure rises from the depths. The figure takes lurching, unsteady steps out of the lake, its pale, naked body gleaming in the darkness.
The winds were withered in the stagnant air and the clouds perished. Darkness no need of aid from them. She was the universe.
The cold moonlight reveals the mangled, horrifying face of Harriet, the creature. Fade to black. End of episode one. Damn. Woo,
woo. Creepy shit.
I mean, you're so nice. What is this? I love this so much. I think the first thing I want to ask is, what in this is like true, and then what is some of the stuff that you kind of fabricated?
Yeah, I mean, the perks of, you know, writing about a bunch of writers is that all of this is very well documented, yeah. And they all have their own diaries and accounts of what happened. So, like, my favorite parts that I was able to pull are, like, Polidori's, like, horrible short stories. It's like, I couldn't make that up, you know, it's just that bad. So, like, taking those real-life inspirations and writings, and then for me it was, you know, kind of coming in and seeing, okay, where are the dramatic moments of tension? Where are the character arcs? So there were definitely time periods that are kind of consolidated. I try to bring the main characters into the fold together as quickly as possible. But a lot of the things, like, you know, the drinking and the drugs and the sex and all the hallucinations they saw were pretty real. And those are, you can find that in Mary Shelley's diaries, Polidori's diaries. So it's like an embarrassment of riches for me as a writer to kind of go in and pick out what works for me.
Yeah, so what did you have the moment where you're like, what if I took... Because Harriet drowned herself, is that right?
Her death is very suspicious. There are multiple theories on what happened, but yeah, so she was pregnant with Percy's child at the time, and that death actually happens a little bit later than what the current story has. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was a scandalous thing, especially because everyone involved were pretty famous established writers. So it was a big London scandal at the time, and I kind of wanted to add, you know, a little bit of a supernatural filter to it.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested in that historical context because, like, these writers are kind of hedonistic. Like, I feel like compared, and you do a good job of establishing their kind of opposing worldview with, like, these protesters and, of course, Westbrook's family. But historically, were they this? Like, Percy Shelley really was having an affair with Mary Godwin while he was married to Harriet.
And... Yeah, I mean, the real life story is just crazy. And, you know, Mary Shelley's parents were both, you know, very radical writers. Her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, is, you know, the proto-feminist. And she fell in love with Percy at a very young age, lost her virginity over her mother's grave. Like, these are biographical details that, like, I as a writer can't even make up. You know, like, the reality is so much better. So, you know, like, their real life drama is what really fueled their dark writings. Mm-hmm. And it's so cool for me to kind of see where they drew their inspirations from their own lives. And, you know, that backstory is so compelling to me, and that's what really compelled me to write this drama.
Yeah. The thing that I love is a lot of horror doesn't really work, or it's just not grounded in character, and it's just kind of, I don't know, I just think horror is either kind of beautiful and elegant, or it just kind of doesn't work. And what I love is you've managed to do that. You managed to write a really character-driven, dramatic, kind of elegant horror story, which clearly borrows from classic gothic tales, because they did the same thing. What do you think are the challenges? Like, what do you think separates good, juicy horror from just bad?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the biggest thing I wanted to accomplish with this script was having every horror element really rooted in character. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, jump scares just for the sake of scaring people. And it's kind of rooted in each character's psychology or their fears or their longings. So kind of really bringing it down to a character in a way that's accessible to people, I feel like, that gets a little bit overlooked. And, you know, I didn't want to just make it an atmospheric horror just for the sake of it. I wanted people to see, you know, these are compulsions and dark thoughts that anyone can have. Like, we all think about what could possibly happen after death. These are just the people who, you know, went a little too far in trying to find out what happens.
Yeah, is the stuff with, like, the laudanum and the ether, like, would these authors really, like experiment with hallucinogens, like...
Yeah.
Wow. That's so interesting.
I mean, that's why I feel like the Gossip Girl comparison is actually not too far. You know, they were very young, rich, ambitious aristocrats. They had all the time and the money in the world, and they really thought that with the resources they had, they would be able to crack the mystery of death and life and be able to figure this out. And, you know, you see that in their writing, and you see that in their real lives.
Well, you see with every literary movement, right? Because the Lost Generation were all alcoholics, and of course, like, the beatniks in the 50s were all doing LSD. So I love how, like, timeless that is, of just, like, these hippie writers just having orgies, you know? Like,
all for art.
All for art, yeah. Oh, man, there's so much I love about this script.
Yeah, I'm a huge horror fan. Like, I love horror movies, and I want to talk about your pacing in this, because you have a very confident pacing in your script, and it doesn't ever force the issue, and it doesn't ever leave you wanting. And I want to talk about that because, again, being such a horror fan, it's really hard to do that without throwing in cheap scares, and you build a lot of character and relationship in the beginning. And I just kind of want to talk about you as a horror writer and how you were able to find the balance between the two of those.
I mean, you know, for me, this is such an ensemble piece, and I kind of thought of it as, like, the Avengers assembling at some point, you know? Like, everyone wants to get to the part where they're in the creepy Swiss villa, because that's the story that's famous. But I kind of wanted to establish where each person's coming from, and for us to really get to know them beforehand. Like, what are their flaws? What are their fears? What do they want most in the world? And how do those things come in conflict with each other, so that when we finally get these five main characters under the same roof, it becomes a very satisfying thing, because now, you know, we're waiting for the fireworks to go off. And, you know, the horror really comes from, each individual's, you know, what they want, their ambitions, but also how those things are in conflict with each other and how these characters are going to continue to fight and struggle with each other as the series goes along.
I am curious, and I know, like, you don't want to reveal too much about where the show goes, but do you picture them staying at this villa for the whole season? Is Harriet the main, like, give us a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there is just so much. I mean, they're not going to be stuck in the villa for too long. And yeah, I really want to follow these characters as they go on their crazy gallivanting journeys all across Europe. And I think I've dropped more than enough hints for a demon baby. So.
Yes. I was hoping, yes.
But yeah,
she's pregnant.
But for me, yeah, like I want each character go on a journey of kind of finding that creative potential within them that could be both, you know, very empowering and also very frightening, especially for the two female main characters. I want Mary to kind of, you know, really find her voice as she discovers, you know, the monster that's both in real life and in her writing. And for Claire to kind of really emerge from this role. I had a lot of fun writing her as the groupie, and thank you so much for playing her with so much fun. but, you know, for her to kind of step out of that shadow and see that she has been used as a puppet, and how is she going to kind of claim her voice and agency from that? As a female writer, like, those are the two characters that I probably gravitated towards the most.
Yeah, I'm, like, really interested in Claire, because there's this whole thing where, like, obviously Lord Byron's kind of this, like, sex god, and, like, he, even in his time, he was, right?
Yes.
There's, like, a bit of a homosexual thing developing, too, because yeah. I know, like, he has such a complicated sexual history, but I guess more than a question, I just am, like, so excited to see that explored.
I know. I mean, I just want to, you know, test them all out in different configurations. But, you know, like, Lord Byron and, to a certain extent, Percy Shelley were, you know, described historically as bisexual and had this very incredibly complicated relationship where they, you know, were very close and then fell apart and drawn back towards each other again. And I, you know, don't want to shy away from all those tensions that would have been present at the group at the time.
How do you feel like, so we haven't featured a ton of historical dramas on the show. So for our listening writers, what's some advice that you have when approaching a historical work, just regarding like research and, you know, keeping it fresh?
And yeah, not making it all about the history.
Yeah.
I mean, I come from a, you know, journalist background. So for me, the biggest challenge was kind of stepping back from my impulse to keep it as accurate as possible. So, you know, at first I really dove into the historical research, tried to read as much as I could. Not just their own writings, but other, you know, contemporary accounts, you know, scholarly dissertations and analysis. And then I got to a point where I was like, okay, like, I think I got enough of a sense. Now I need to tell, you know, what's the best narrative that's possible. So once I kind of centered towards the theme and what I wanted each character arc to be, then, like, I kind of had to, you know, wed what my vision for the story was with actual historical research.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there are purists out there who feel like I've taken a lot of liberties, and I have, but I hope that people can see that, you know, the characters to the core are kind of similar to their historical counterparts, and the stories and the messages that they wrote about are still resonant today.
Well, you need to, because, like, no one wants to watch, I mean, there are documentaries about this already, right. So, like, we can watch those. Like, we want this, and what a cool way, as, like, a lit nerd, I love the idea of, like, a fun, creepy, you know, sex and drugs story of these literary giants. And the cool thing is, I do think this stuff is selling now. Like, I don't know if you watch Rain on the CW. I don't watch that show, but I just think, like...
Well, I know. And you should stop watching it.
In retrospect, I could have probably done a better job. Penny Dreadful, we talked about at the top, which I just... I think this thing could sell. I mean, and I want it to. And part of the reason we bring stuff on the show is to nudge it. Are there any networks that you kind of had in mind for something like this?
Yeah, well, the show is kind of in the early stages of development right now, so I can't give away too many details.
Awesome.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's really exciting time as a TV writer, because, you know, the industry is booming and there are so many places now that something like this that would have been considered as niche a few years ago, now there's more places for these stories and voices to be told, which is very exciting. But I hope to have more good news in the script in the future, and I'll definitely keep you guys posted.
We'll announce it on the show. Please keep us posted for sure. Would you ever consider anthologizing, like, the show? Because I'm, like, this group is so interesting, but I'm so fascinated by literary groups, and I would love to see The Lost Generation on TV or The Beatniks.
I actually was joking about that. I said season 2 would be Inklings, and that's a famous group of J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and the Oxford group. I would love to do the Bloomsbury group and, you know, like Virginia Woolf. For me, as a lit nerd, it's always fun to kind of imagine the backstories and all the drama behind the literary icons, because I think it's so easy for us to like elevate them to the status of icons. But, you know, they were humans, and that's where these stories come from. And it's so fascinating to kind of pull back that psychology and really access these people as real flesh and blood human beings.
Mm. Which I think is so essential to historical drama, you know? You got to care about these characters. They're not, you know, you can't paint these wooden, dust-covered people. You have to make them alive, which you've done so well in this pilot. Any other questions from our panel?
I always ask this. Have you ever had this read before? And if so, or if not, is there anything that you liked or didn't like today? Things that worked for you? Things you want to change?
I mean, I've had it informally read by, you know, other people in my writer's group. And this is kind of my first time with, you know, professional actors doing it. And it's always incredibly gratifying as someone, you know, I'm just typing out words on my laptop. And to see people and, like, have those words put in other people's mouths, it's, like, I appreciate it so much. Thank you guys so much.
You
guys did a wonderful job. Like, I was having a great time, and I was laughing at parts that I didn't think were funny when I wrote it. I was like, oh no, these people are ridiculous. And it's fun to laugh at them. So.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah. Do you have any questions for us about the pilot? Anything specifically with the writing?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to know, you know, what are the kind of parts that like really jumped out to you? What are parts that you feel like could be fleshed out? I love getting feedback.
It's in really good shape. I mean, like,
yeah,
I
love Claire. Claire's a great part. The doctor's a great part. Yeah. Like, that's like, I think in any show, it's like sort of the like supporting character that, oh, you just love.
Jerry from Parks and Rec. Kind of the whipping post. Every show needs one.
Yeah, I mean, structurally, it's just so well done. Like, from a horror, like a horror fan's point of view. And we already talked about that, and I hate to not be able to give any sort of like constructive criticism, but it just felt so, yeah, it was just really well paced. You got everything you wanted. It was excellent.
Thank you so much.
There's a reason it's in development.
Yeah, she knows.
The scenes with all five writers, I think, are my favorite. Just because to see them all vibe together, all their different personalities in one room, it's just
they were the
great.
Most fun to write.
Yeah. So congratulations on that. Because I really enjoyed that part. Those parts.
You.
Well, I can't wait to see this thing on TV when it airs. I'll be watching. And thank you so much for being here, Eileen. We really appreciate
it. Thank you. I appreciate it so much.
It's really fun. Guys, this has been the Unproduced Table Read. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you like today's script, I'd recommend episode 6. It's a script called Company Town. It's actually American set, but it's also a historical drama all about Pullman, Illinois, where this kind of railroad magnate sort of creates this complex economic system, and there's race relations and there's sex. And in the same way that Eileen's done today, Samantha, who wrote that script, really takes a historical time and makes it alive. So I'd recommend that script as well.
Very good script.
And these scripts also, guys, were printed to us heavily discounted in Burbank from ARA Printing on Magnolia Boulevard. Eileen, I don't know if you live in the Valley, but these, if you go with the promo code TableRead, you'll get 10% off of your order, and they're already so heavily discounted. You can get features printed for like $3 bound.
It's really awesome.
They're the best. That's in Burbank. That's ARA Printing. And thanks so much for being here today, guys. My name is Jeff Graham. If you guys want to find me online, you can do so on Twitter at Jeffrey C. Graham. You can pitch me a script there if you want. Next week we are reading, let me think for a second. Oh yeah, it's a half hour kind of dramedy pilot. I think that has like shades of Transparent. It's about polyamory. So
cool.
It's if you ever watched Big Love on HBO, it's a funnier, I think, version of that. But I love Big Love, not to put it down, just a little different. So tune in for that, and we'll see you then. That's 10 a.m. next week.
Thanks for tuning in, guys. My name is Timothy Mike. You can find me everywhere at I Am Timothy Mike.
I'm Roxy Stryer. You can find me everywhere at Roxy Stryer.
Everybody, I'm Andrew Guy. Thanks for watching today.
Hi, guys. I'm William Pinkham. Find me, William.Pinkham.
Hey, that's Haley O'Connor on Twitter as Haley O'Connor. That made sense.
And Eileen, one more time, if people want to, I mean, it sounds like you're in development, but if people want to reach out to you, chat with you about the script, the best way to do that?
Sure. You can find me on Instagram at EJShim.
Great. Awesome. Guys, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you next week at 10 a.m. and have a great week.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principals.